Hi, it's Mark Zinkowitz, and I'm at the Agricultural Bioscience International Conference in Winnipeg, Manitoba this week. I sat down today with Rohit Shukla. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Los Angeles-based LARTA Institute. He's an established thought leader and respected practitioner on innovation, commercialization, and enterprise and technology-led economic development. He had some fascinating thoughts on the agricultural industry, including the seed industry. And he explained to me why innovation often doesn't come from where we think it comes from and why it's important for our industry to understand that. Enjoy. Can you give me a little bit of information about yourself, your background, and also the LARTA Institute as well?
Yeah. So I've been a resident of California since 1979. I had a couple of businesses in information technology and computing and communications, and I have a master's from Loyola Marymount University in Communication Arts and Sciences. I have a master's from Cambridge University in the philosophy of science and politics and sociology and economics. And I started LARTA Institute in 1993 as a means of being able to focus on innovations in California initially because of the extreme economic distress that the state felt in the early 90s. It's hard to know that it actually did have distress from the defense downsizing that occurred at the end of the first Gulf War. So, you know, initially it was based in California, across the technology horizons of every single aspect of technology. And then and then we took it national after the program itself sunsetted. We took it national and went to many of the federal agencies that are involved in funding science through small companies, not just researchers and universities, through small companies, a program called SBIR. And from there, we grew this practice in technologies that feed, fuel, and heal the world, which is agriculture, which is energy, and which is healthcare. Those three areas are very important to us. Our principal sponsors, if you call them that, or partners, as I like to call them, are these federal agencies and also many governments around the world. We work with Canadians, have worked with Canadians in BC. We've worked with the Canadian Trade Commissions to be able to produce a sort of an event that allows Canadians to be able to find partners and find opportunities for their products, in particular in agriculture.
You have a degree in the philosophy of science, and in the seed industry we talk a lot about innovation. And in your talk today you spoke about where innovation really comes from. Isn't often where people think it comes from. Can you give me a little bit of insight on that?
So, you know, I mean, look, I think it's the problem with innovation is there's too many different ways of being able to broadcast its influence. So it's like the blind man and the elephant, you know, each one with a particular part of it and none of them being able to describe the whole. And if you look at innovation, it's got many aspects to it. Number one is obviously the idea itself, something that has some novelty. Something that is able to take something and move it further than it has been capable of doing. Something that is also able to add something to something that exists. These are all aspects of innovation. Unfortunately, the way it has been taken very often is as if it has to be something so completely new as to transform humanity. And frankly, we've done so much already in humanity. All we need to do is just to even look at the accretive influence of our new knowledge. And new knowledge is coming all the time from new insights in science. So innovation is linked, in fact, to ingenuity in the science, to the aspects of creation that exist in science, but also comes with a tremendous amount of doubt, just like science does, a tremendous uncertainty about the results. There shouldn't be this feeling that just because you're innovative, you're going to be successful. You know, you're going to add to the total knowledge that we have about a particular process or a particular thing, but it doesn't mean anything because that innovation is going to be taken forward by somebody else, to somebody else, to somebody else, and this is a continuing process. It sort of never stops. The other thing about innovation is when you come upon obstacles that are effectively in the path of your moving forward, because it's going to be a continuing moving target, I mean, it's never going to stop. It shouldn't. It's the old dialectic, you know. If you're gonna do that, then you have to necessarily be able to recognize when things have become warped. Okay. The issue with GMOs, for example, which had to do with seed, and you know, very often, I mean, when you start with agriculture, you start with the seed, right? You have to start with the seed. Was effectively perverted by the fact that we did not respond actively enough to the objections being raised by people who knew nothing about the subject. So this is a case of innovation which is really remarkable in terms of its results and effects for farmers, being destroyed in terms of its intent because there was a very little engagement on the part of people at Monsanto in particular, right? And this has affected many seed manufacturers, many seed companies in the same way. Despite the best efforts of companies like Syngenta and Bayer and so on and so forth for crop protection, for seed coatings and so on and so forth, it's a major issue. And so innovation is multifanged, it's multi-headed, it comes from different sources and it doesn't stop. And it's not just about novelty, it's about the continuing accretive process of creation and destruction and creation and destruction.
One of those innovations in seed is gene editing, which you also commented on. Can you give me a little bit of insight into your thoughts on gene editing? You described it as literally being able to cut out defects in a plant.
Yes. So it started, as you know, with CRISPR-Cas9 and the insights that a team of researchers in Berkeley, Jennifer Doudna and her group, were able to come up with. And part of the issue there was simply understanding the way bacteria respond to threats from viruses. They essentially make a copy of the virus's DNA, and then they use that copy to effectively snip out portions of that DNA that they know are going to leave the virus vulnerable. So using that insight into plants is a remarkable thing. I mean, but it's part of the ingenuity of scientists and of researchers to be able to understand, look, they can do that, we can do it. We have to engineer it in, yes. We have to understand that there's a certain sequence in the genetic makeup of a plant that if you were to snip this particular thing, would essentially take away the thing that's causing a distress. It's a beautiful, imaginative, almost artistic way of dealing with an effective problem that we've had for quite some time. So it talk about innovation. This is led to now an explosion of activity in the understanding of the genome of plants, in the understanding of how to deal with certain kinds of endemic and generic diseases that have become part of the landscape of plants, and how to effectively deal with it, not just on a lab basis, but even right there in the field. Which is a great thing. So, you know, the tools of gene editing, by the way, are things that are going to have to be perfected for the use of by farmers and other people so they can do it very quickly. You remember, in order to sequence a gene, okay, or sequence a genome of any kind, it used to take weeks. You can do it now over lunch. Similarly with gene editing, at the moment it's a little bit more esoteric than most people can apply in the particular context of a field or a farm or seeds or whatever. But the tools are becoming cheaper, faster, better. The way of computing this stuff on a desktop computer or even on a laptop in the field and an iPad has ruggedized our ability to deal with genes. So therefore, gene editing itself has now become, or will become, I would say, will become commonplace, which is a remarkable thing. I mean, what I don't like is the fact that it's being, you know, it has to be regulated in the context of babies. You know, because I mean that's drawing a line under the science. But you know that's true of any science,
My last question: you talked a lot about social media, calling it a battleground. Why do you see it as a battleground as far as science is concerned?
Because I think it has basically allowed the proliferation of extreme views that have no basis in fact. Science has no defense when you're dealing with non-fact-based opinion. Opinion masquerading as fact. The truth of the matter is social media is highly democratic in the sense of anybody can say anything at any time and essentially gain a following through gaming the system or through being able to make outrageous comments and becoming a celebrity overnight. And therefore having a following to go along with the crap you're putting out. A lot of it is crap. It's not based on fact. It's based on faddism. It's based on the whispers of all your followers. It's based on feelings and emotions and all kinds of things. And who the hell do these people think they are? I mean, in that sense, it is a battleground because science is conservative. By nature, science depends on doubt. Science's progress depends on being able to disprove a well-understood hypothesis. You tell me something. You come up with this as a seed farmer, okay, as a seed researcher. You come up with something. I can guarantee you, in order for it to become accepted truth, it has to go through a process that will essentially destroy your faith in humanity. Why? Because they're trying to disprove what you've come up with in order to be able to prove it. That's a process that you cannot expect in social media, where assertion becomes fact, assertion becomes action, action becomes destructive, action takes down people who've spent lifetimes doing this stuff, who've got extraordinary insights and understand that everything is ambiguous until you prove it certainly. And even then, something is going to come up to essentially threaten it. You know, that doesn't happen in social media. It's a cascade of opinions that become this extraordinary truth unto themselves. That's why I think it's a battleground.
Some great insights. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
For more information on the LARTA Institute, visit larta.org. Thanks for listening.